Welcome to the European CME Forum podcast. European CME Forum is a not-for-profit organization that promotes multi-channel discussion on matters relating to European and global CME CPD. My name is Eugene Pozniak. I'm the program director of European CME Forum. The 16th annual European CME Forum took place 8th to 10th of November 2023 in The Hague, the Netherlands. This is part two of the 16 ECF highlight episodes. Today, we will showcase some discussion points around the rules and regulations in CME CPD and how this impacts stakeholders. There are three main parts to this episode. First, we will look at the different stakeholder perspectives on valuing and defining independence in CME CPD. This will be followed by a discussion on harmonizing different accreditation systems. And then we round off the episode with an industry perspective on the grant application process. But before we dive into the meeting highlights, I'd like to spend a minute or two to offer some background to some of the more noteworthy CME CPD developments in 2023. Firstly, EACME 3.0. In June 2023, the UEMS EACME launched their CME accreditation standards called EACME 3.0. This was an update to EACME 2.0, which was launched about 10 years ago, with occasional updates since. What has ended up frustrating the CME community in Europe is that there was little substantive change in the standards to meet the seismic shifts we've seen in international compliance standards, both within the medical and educational fields, as well as in our own respective countries as citizens. It seems that EACME is now speaking with third parties to understand their challenges, including European medical societies, the Good CME Practice Group, and even groups in the US such as the CME Coalition, to work out how things can be improved, and we look forward to their meeting in March 2024 for an update. The second challenge of 2023 we find in the UK, and how UK healthcare professionals are being excluded from internationally funded accredited education. But this is in response to a 2022 ruling following a PMCPA investigation. This is the organisation that administers the ABPI Code of Practice, the self-regulating body of the UK pharmaceutical industry. In essence, the UK has not implemented the full set of rules around independence in accredited medical education, FPR Article 16, Annex 3, and the related rules. The PMCPA investigation led to a judgment that has now codified the requirement in the UK that the pharmaceutical company's supporter must control all education that it provides funding for, even if it's funded by an arm's-length independent educational grant. The only solution open to pharma to remain compliant and avoid being found in breach of the Code of Practice in the UK is to geo-block, uninvite, or otherwise exclude UK healthcare professionals from international CME. More information about both these challenges can be found via the links in the show notes, especially the letter to the editor of the Journal of CME, authored by members of the Good CME Practice Group, which first identified the problem in the UK at the very beginning of 2023, and to also describe their shared concerns from a provider perspective about EACME 3.0. This leads on nicely to today's highlights from 16 ECF. One of the key themes of this year's meeting was valuing and defining independence in medical education. In our first clip, Sophie Wilson, a CME provider, outlines how different rules around independence have caused issues in Europe.
I think that the big challenge is that as a UK provider, the ABPI, which is the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry, for those and regulates the pharmaceutical industry in the UK, they have not signed up to FPIA, Article 16, and FPIA is the European equivalent to the ABPI, and they recognise the need for independent medical education, and that's different to pharma-driven education. And it's nothing to do with quality, both can be high quality, it's just to do with perception and transparency. So the ABPI did not take on all of the FPA recommendations about independence, and there is a result, if you're now a pharmaceutical company and a provider working in the UK, if I get funds from a UK pharma company, ABPI wants them to review my content, because they're responsible for the content, because the independence wasn't clearly taken over. But if they review my content, then I break all the rules for CME. So that's the issue in a nutshell. In Europe, the issues are more about how the accreditors view us as independent providers, or are we, you know, so it's about how you draw the line between us and our funders and show that we're independent, and having the accreditors accept that as valid.
We also heard about IACME's position on industry support from Natalie Paulus.
Well, actually, when we implemented EAC CME 3.0, we introduced some new elements such as microlearning, blended learning accreditation. But the misperception would probably be regarding industry support, because people had the impression that we had changed our criteria. And actually, no, we haven't changed our criteria. We just tried to bring some clarification into them, because the EAC CME spirit is that the doctor, and it has always been what we've been believing in from the beginning, is that the doctor should be able to attend an accredited event without being necessarily exposed to commercial information if he doesn't want to. So that has always been clear to us, and we realized with time, because we were receiving a lot of emails from providers asking, can I put the sponsor's leaflet in the participants' congress bag? Can I have the sponsor's logo and the lanyards and all that kind of practical questions? That we realized that it wasn't clear for many providers what we considered to be an independent CME activity. So actually, we didn't change the criteria, we just clarified them. Yes, so actually in the first version of EAC CME 3.0, we defined this issue as unrestricted educational sponsorship. But then we had, following the consultation that we had indeed comments about the term sponsorship. So we've now changed it to unrestricted educational support to distinguish it from all the other sponsorship opportunities that are offered to industry, such as exhibition booths or organization of satellite symposia.
Has that been published?
Yes, it's available on our website. So we first sent the EAC CME 3.0 just before we launched the new platform, and actually just a few days before we resent a new version, sorry for that, but of the criteria where we amended the term sponsorship.
Interestingly, there's been a change since the meeting. While we just heard Natalie Paulus calling it version 2 with the removal of the inappropriate use of the wording around sponsorship, in just the past few days, IACME has further amended the standards, so we're now on version 3. From what we can work out in this latest amendment, they've removed some of the punitive measures around corporate recognition and advertising in common areas outside of the education and exhibition spaces in conferences.
Yes, so we have to be clear, EAC CME is not against industry. We all acknowledge that the events could not be organized if there wasn't any industry support, and we wouldn't have anything to accredit if there wasn't industry support. Or we say that, and the support of the sponsors can be acknowledged also in the scientific program and on the event website, so we've got nothing against that, but we really want to promote independent and commercial and activities free from commercial bias. And we've also slightly adapted our criteria regarding the presence of industry speakers on the program, for example. It's not that we don't allow industry speakers. We do in some circumstances, if it's to talk about the scientific merit of their research. So there are ways where we allow industry to be visible. So EAC CME is totally aware that we need that providers need industry to organize their activities. It's just as I said before, that the doctor who wants to know more about industry will go and look for the information, but he shouldn't be bombarded when attending an event with industry information. He's heard about first to to get the scientific content, and the rest is extra.
We were fortunate to hear from a US Pharma Grant Office, who has responsibility for funding activities in Europe and rest of the world, giving some very clear explanations from a pharma perspective about CME in Europe. We hear from Sue Ellen Toomer on valuing independent education and the ambiguity between different settings.
So we see medical education come in different forms, right? So we do have company-led medical education, and there's a time and a place for that. But we also value, and you know, that should be evidenced by the fact that, you know, there's a team of 20 people at my company who do only independent medical education grants. So it's valued, it's part of the overall plan, but it's distinct and separate. However, what we have to do and some of the challenges is really, it ends up looking internally, which is because of, say, this example, on the face of it for a HCP, but even some of our colleagues internally, they can look and feel very similar. So then they become confused as to, okay, well, what is the difference between company-led and independent medical education? They look and feel the same. And so then there's a lot of education that needs to happen internally about what the difference is, what value each one brings. And it's complicated by the fact that in Europe, there are different accrediting bodies with different standards. Company-led education could be accredited as well. So, you know, in the US, we have a very, very clear model. We have government regulations, we have ACCME accreditation standards that both lift up and funders who value independent medical education and are willing to, you know, they enforce all of those things. So all three together kind of lift up the value of independence. Move over to some other areas, it's ambiguous because each of the three have different interpretations. So from the provider side, from the accreditation side, and from the pharma side, there are different standards. And so it gets very muddy as to, you know, is there a value for independence or is there not? And if is one upholding it, maybe the others are not. So if the whole structure really isn't in place, it's not necessarily going to be priority on the situation you're talking about. So that's why it varies so much.
Okay, thank you. That's clear. And is this do you feel from your perspective, is this something that's getting more muddy and more complicated and more of a headache, or has it kind of always been pretty cut and dried in the US and a bit of a mess when you come over to Europe?
It's been an ongoing educational point, I think. It's just, how do you explain, you know, the sort of the do's and don'ts and compliance of when we're dealing with independent medical education when, you know, they have an example that may contradict that, you know, oh, well, we were able to talk to this provider as an example. So again, if it's not consistently applied, mm-hmm. then you don't have sort of a consistent standard way of approaching it. And so I become one voice of many, unfortunately.
Ava Tullman then went on to discuss a broader definition of independence with input from David Vodoshek, Sophie Wilson, Sue Ellen Toomer, Jean-Philippe Nathalie, and a final word from Dean Beals.
Can I also make a comment? Because we are talking independency always in relations to funding, yeah? But I think I would like to broaden this a little bit in conflict of interest or bias. And even an independent program, depending on the faculty, could have a bias or conflict of interest, depending of who the speakers are. So for instance, I certainly have a bias because I was working 32 years in the industry. So that's a bias I have, yeah. I certainly have a bias because I always tried to get as many women in faculty as men. So I always was for gender parity. It was very important for me. That's a bias for me, yeah. So you could have somebody who is the chair of the guidelines of a society. This person might have a bias, yeah. So I think we are kind of focused so much on the funding, but maybe we also should start to discuss it a little bit broader.
So what
we see currently is, first slide is, I received a grant from A, B, and C, I was a lecturer for company A, B, C, etc., etc. But we don't really see, I'm also on the board of, you know, my institution, I'm the chair of guidelines, I'm actually in the committee for women for oncology, etc., etc. But all this, yeah, is influencing also how we interpret data, how we look at stuff, yeah, how we argue. And I think we need to be a little bit more broadened and be fully transparent, yeah.
Thank you, that's great.
That's part of the accreditation process. Yeah. To resolve or mitigate any conflicts of interest. Now, if their standards are different from accrediting body to accrediting body, that's a different story.
Can I just support what Eva just said? I mean, in the sense that biases have to be acknowledged. It does not necessarily have to do with accrediting a particular session, perhaps just spreading the culture that what all possible biases are, which should be listed. One good example that I have noticed in one of the lectures we had in a small symposium, and there was a surgeon, and his first bias was private practice, which it was very honest, you know, and it is a bias.
Thank you. That's great.
And I think as providers, we have a responsibility when we're inviting our faculty. Even before we invite them, we should go through some form of vetting to make sure that whoever we're inviting is relevant, is appropriate for that education. And then we need to mitigate the bias. And so once we've invited them, we also need to then ask them for their potential conflicts. And I think you're right, Eva, that should be more than just I'm a speaker for X company. It should be all those other things, guideline committees, etc. And then we have to mitigate. And sometimes, I mean, we have had faculty, we've said, actually, I'm really sorry. We're going to have to find somebody else. And I think as providers, it is our responsibility to do that.
As an accrediting body, we in France, we assess every CPD provider and every CPD activities. And we asked for a CPD provider and for each CPD activity to disclose interest. And in France, we make a difference between links of interest. There could be conflict of interest. You can ask or say something with a link of interest as soon as you disclose it at the beginning of your, okay? But if you have a conflict of interest, it could be complicated to hold the session. So we make a difference between these two terms.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
One of the challenges, I think, is the people that we want to invite, the experts, are the people that have, in some ways, the most conflicts, right? Because they work with everybody. They know the material. So I think the solution is sunshine. Make that aware. Make people aware to what Eva was saying before. Make the learners aware of all of their conflicts, because nobody is conflict-free. Everybody has a point of view about something, and there's no way, and why should we just mitigate based on the fact that they are a speaker for a pharmaceutical company, for instance? There's so many other biases. There's so many other things. Just make the learners aware of it, and I think that will go a long way to at least solving part of the problem.
Another important topic at the meeting was about the rules and regulations around accreditation. In this next clip, Kate Regnier of the ACCME and Reinhard Griebenow of EBAC discuss the International Academy for CPD Accreditation and the prospect of harmonization of accreditation systems internationally.
I have been surprised at the continued lack of standardization of the accreditation models. And I think that is something that is potentially unique to Europe, to have to deal with all Europe and the UK, to have to deal with all of the diversity here is it has to be chaotic for all of you. And so sort of talking about standardization. You know, I'm thrilled that Natalie's here talking about ways that the different accrediting bodies can simplify the process so that it isn't just bureaucracy that changes based on jurisdiction, I think, is what we should be working on.
So some of you I know are very involved in the International Academy. And one of the questions that, you know, we've just had the panel around the difference that goes on outside of Europe, and even to your comment, Kate, about the misorganization in Europe. So what are we doing to try and get some sort of standardization on a global scale? Where are we at with that? Because obviously, if you look at the website, there are some countries, even in my part of the world, who have joined, but is that an ongoing discussion and attempt?
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. That's a great question. And Jean-Philippe and Reinhard are members of the Academy too, so I'd ask them to weigh in. The International Academy for CPD Accreditation has a website that describes our activities. It's an organization made up of accrediting bodies and regulators throughout the world. We're just trying to learn from each other and look for ways we can simplify the processes for all of you. One of the first things we did was create a glossary of terms that was helpful. We wrote a white paper on independence and transparency, sort of value statements. And most recently, we've adopted standards, international standards for CPD accreditation. And our goal is to get organizations to submit themselves, accrediting bodies, submit themselves for review to get feedback on where we are against those international standards. So several of our organizations have already done that. ACCME has done that. EBAC has done that. Really, if we could get all of the systems in the world adopting these international standards, then we could have a single set of requirements that would hopefully make things easier. Do you, Reinhard, Jean-Philippe?
Yeah, I would like to comment on that from a slightly different perspective. Means that evidence nowadays is generated not nationwide, but internationally. Mm-hmm. So physicians get their information from nearly everywhere in the world. And the question is, on which information can I rely, which is trustworthy, and which not? And what we see is that there are, regarding accreditation, if it comes to CME, there are several players in the field. Organizations which are in the end private and have no governmental legitimation, no legal background, for example. This applies, for example, in Europe to all these organizations starting with E, yeah, for European. That's private, no legitimation. So the question is, why go, for example, to EBAC or to EACCME? Because there is no supervision. The EU Commission says, do as you like. Yeah. And for these organizations, it's interesting to refer to a common framework, which at the same time gives doctors the confidence that organizations working according to this framework will probably give me more confidence that I can rely on information coming from the US or Canada, I don't know, or vice versa. And I think this is an important issue. And there are, as always, some pros and some cons. Organizations like INDPC in France, Jean-Philippe is a lean person, but very strong because government is backing him.
Exactly.
And I guess, and you will comment on that, the con is that he is not very flexible. Yeah, and that's true. If his peers decide to implement something which is not sensible, he has to apply it. And I think the beauty for organizations like EBAC is that we think we have a good concept and we have discussed that with others and it complies with the standards. We can implement it, maybe not tomorrow for technical reasons, but very, very quickly. Nevertheless, whether it takes longer or you might be able to follow this process quicker, I think this is not about creating a new organization which has power. The International Academy is a completely informal gathering. It has no legal status, so we have to come to a consensus and stick to that. And if this happens, I think this is much more valuable than being forced by, I don't know, WHO or UN or whatsoever.
For those of us that have relationships with the accreditors in our countries, we should really be encouraging them to come to you.
For sure.
Got it.
For sure.
Definitely.
Our final topic today covers an industry perspective on the grant proposal process. This next clip features Lawrence Sherman in conversation with Sue Ellen Toomer on her tips for how education providers can approach supporters and writing proposals.
So what's the best way for a provider to walk up to a supporter? Not to you, Sue Ellen, mm-hmm. but to a supporter that maybe they don't know.
So I would start first with going on their websites. Now, I'll say again, the first time, and I'm sure it'll come up again and again. So my initial training was in the U.S., very, very, very focused on the U.S., and that's where you'll see many of the grant offices actually are, but they're responsible for U.S. plus, whatever that might be, and maybe in country, any country outside of the United States is managed separately, as an example. But if they have a website, go to it, read it. If they have a portal, sign up. There will be information on that portal whether or not you submit a grant. Read it. I can't say that we make it easy. Every portal is different. Every legal and compliance in a company is different. Some people ask for attachments. Some people don't. Some have character limits. Some don't. But all I can say is that, if you're asking for financial support, be ready to have to pivot and change your application that you probably are intending to send to 3 or 4 or 5 supporters. You're going to have to modify it. It is kind of just the nature of the business that we are in. So you do have to follow and be very considerate of that. In terms of communication with people like me, so people who are sitting in the grant office, that's something you're just gonna have to ask and be respectful of the fact that some may not want to talk to you at all. And it could be I was with a company that was under a CIA. We couldn't talk to anyone. Before, after, feedback, no feedback, we couldn't give anything. So really understand and respect that. Use networking events to be able to at least gauge that. And then that's how you kind of move forward, is to be able to understand how much information you can and cannot get.
Can you just explain a CIA? Everybody may know what that is.
Yes, so a CIA is a corporate,
corporate integrity.
Thank you, many abbreviations. And so if there are findings, a company is put under that, which then becomes, and it could be because of other reasons, it could be because of violations that have happened somewhere in the company, which then requires that company to then reassess what they are doing and go through a period of remediation before they're able to come out of that CIA. And so usually one of the things, because funding is a very regulated and very sensitive topic, it is one area that's always gonna be looked at, always part of audits. So in that situation, there may or may not have been findings, I can't remember. I wasn't there for the actual when the decision came down. But we became very closed in because they wanted to sort of eliminate all the areas of potential risk while they are trying to sort of reassess and decide how they're going to conduct business. So
So it may be that you'd love to speak to people, but you can't.
Correct.
And so it has to be an understanding.
Yes.
So what are three things that our non-US-based folks and our US-based folks should consider including in a proposal if they've never received funding from a company before? What will let them stand out to a you? I think that was a question that sort of came up before.
Yes, so I'll answer that, but I also want to hear from Allison too.
So do I.
Because, you know, having being the one who's submitting to all of these companies, I mean, if I'm missing something, let me know. So first is a solid proposal. I do not want a 70-page proposal. Please. The volume, you know, the volume of work we already have is very difficult. So, and I wish we could have had Celeste and Sophie's workshop at another time, because I think if you don't understand or feel like you're comfortable in what a proposal should have, I'm sure that would have been a great workshop to go to. So really be clear and concise in what you're presenting. Please give us, you know, a top line summary, because we need that for our grant reviews and to share with our committees. Needs assessments. They are not literature reviews. This is not going for submission in a journal. So I don't need a therapeutic area landscape for the last 25 years. I need to understand that the justification for why you're proposing this education. Bring in literature and data and information that you're pulling in, but bring in your proprietary information, the survey data you get, feedback from faculty you've worked with, outcomes, all of those. There's so many sources of information, not just, you know, what's been published in the literature, and it should be concise. Secondly, you know, kind of as a to that, geographic scope. So we have a lot of US-based providers and ex-US providers who like to do crisscross and do both, which is great, but we need to understand the geographic scope and make sure you tailor your needs assessment to the audience you are proposing. I do not want to know about US-based learners if we're talking about European clinicians. Unless it's a global program, which you might have to address, you know, the different areas. So that's one thing. Learning objectives. Keep them very actionable. I like to think of them as like SMART goals, like we do for other areas. How are you going to be able to measure against them? So make them very clear and concise. And I think, you know, the rest of it, I don't need a 70-page document. I do need to understand how you choose faculty, not necessarily who they are, but what you do to consider faculty, budget, what's your format look like, and how is that format of education you're proposing make sense for what you're doing. I do not expect that, you know, you're going to get the highest level outcomes for a 15-minute video. Do you know what I mean? So you have to be able to realistic goals and realistic expectations with what you're proposing to what your outcomes are going to be.
We conclude this segment with some final thoughts from Sue Ellen Tuma on what she feels should be avoided in grant proposals.
Well, I'll say this, which is to kind of go back to the point we were just talking about. You know, in my experience, actually, RFPs are less common, but I know some companies really operate that way to help manage. So they're looking at grants for a specific area all at one time. So right now, we definitely, in the company that I'm in, we definitely work on a more rolling basis, mm-hmm. So as needed. So for me, where I am on our team is really looking at now at the global, more global related applications. So across therapeutic areas and areas that we actually look outside of the United States, primarily it's in the US. But for me, what I'm looking for in those areas is understanding really how you're addressing needs regionally or by country, and really making sure that you know, it's not, as an example, perhaps a US-based company giving me a US-based needs assessment for a US-based activity, but with global distribution. it's not going to make any sense. You really have to think about who your audience is and understand that I need to understand from you what the needs and the gaps are locally, where you're hoping to really reach an audience. And then also understanding local and regional regulations too. So when we're talking about many of the activities that we see supported, they can be accessed by anyone anywhere in the world. So what have you kind of created around your activity to ensure it has the right disclaimers and information for the intended audience, that it has the right accreditation information, that that you're actually going to receive the right, you told me you were going to get 5,000 oncologists, that you get the right specialty audience. So I'm always, because I was on the provider side, I'm always looking at the execution of it as I'm thinking about the grant proposal itself, and really how well is this proposal going to translate into an actual program. So as we get more, as a lot of these US grant teams are now looking at more ex-US or US plus applications, those are the things on top of just generally what the education, what you're proposing as education, that's what we're looking for, at least that's what I'm looking for. Because I think it's where it's sort of the devil in the details that we have to make sure that we keep very vigilant on.
I hope you enjoyed these select 16 ECF highlights on the rules and regulations in CME-CPD. Take a look at the show notes for links to the organizations and publications discussed here. If you attended the meeting itself, please complete the brief post-meeting survey and let us know your thoughts. We will be closing the survey at the end of 2023, so do add your voice before then. Registered participants will also have exclusive access to recordings from the meeting sessions, which will be made live in the new year. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week for our final episode of the year. While we were going through the recordings, we thought we would treat you to a year-end festive bonus episode. From the feedback we've received, it looks like the most popular session of the whole meeting was the one looking at how CME-CPD is implemented around the world. So we will share with you a recording of this session, which will feature insights from education experts from Australia, India, Saudi Arabia, and Ukraine. Join us then as we discuss more things CME-CPD.